The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and by popular demand, I'm delighted to be able to speak to James Thorn of Columbia Threadneedle, one of the UK's finest small and mid-cap investors. So welcome, James.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I think we're going to have a very topical debate today, but let's just start with a bit of macro. Since we last spoke, sort of 6 months ago, we've had the sort of a mini banking crisis, and then we had the central banks increasing interest rates, with the Bank of England pushing up by 50 bips last week to 5% on the back of sort of like their fears of entrenched inflation. So putting all that together, what's your sort of view for equities for the rest of the year and into 2024?
Thanks, Paul.
Sorry,
an interesting question, a difficult one. I think there's two sides of this coin. I think, as we've said before, and you've told a lot of your listeners, there's an awful lot of value in UK small and mid-cap, and that continues to be the case, even though, obviously, as interest rates go up, the cost of your money effectively goes up as well, and therefore that has an impact on reducing asset prices slightly. But really, even a 50 bip rise doesn't destroy all that value sitting there. I think we are going to have probably more volatility over the next couple of quarters as a result of the Bank of England's policy. You know, they're targeted with really one outcome, which is getting CPI down. And they're paranoid about the fact that they've obviously forecasted quite a huge reduction in inflation. And over the last couple of months, that hasn't started to happen. We still think that will happen in the next couple of months. You can see it in terms of the PPI, which is sort of a leading indicator in terms of the costs of goods that companies are buying that go into the supply chain. Now, that has come right back. And obviously, energy prices have come back a long, long way. So there are still a lot of things that are going to fall in price in the next couple of months. And we also had a big impact because of things like fresh vegetables from Europe. And that was partly seasonal effects and things like the weather. I think the one thing that the bank is very worried about is labour inflation. And obviously, labour inflation sort of has surprised the market in staying higher. I think there's an interesting point here. I mean, employment is still incredibly high, and there are still a large number of vacancies in the marketplace. This is a structural issue in the UK, not really as a result of Brexit. It's actually a lot of it as a result of the number of people who are off long-term sick in the UK marketplace. And we've all heard about the very long waiting list at the NHS. But I think people's expectations of inflation over the next couple of years actually come down quite dramatically when you look at surveys of people, what people expect inflation to be in a year's time and 2 years' time. And as a result, I think the labour market is really addressing the inflation of the last couple of years. And I don't think the labour demands will stay at the sort of levels that they have done as we go through the next year or so. And as a result of that, I think the Bank of England can ease off the pressure on interest rates.
When do you think that will happen, James? The policy response, if you're right on that, the inflation rolling over and it sort of like calls off that the wage growth, then when would you anticipate Andrew Bailey taking his foot off
the I think the Bank of England has got, you know, is sort of myopic in their view about, you know, we've got to put interest rates up again. So they probably will go up again in August because that, you know, you can see the voting was very much in favor of it. And one of the, you know, the sort of inflation bears, if you like, has left the committee. But I think come the autumn, when the data gets a lot harder, I think they'll be in a position to start to actually look to reduce interest rates. And it'll surprise people actually how quickly they potentially reverse all of that. Obviously, at the moment, that means, you know, some of the companies exposed to the housing market, and we've seen the house builders' share prices collapse in the last week. I think in the next couple of quarters could be quite difficult, and trading in the second half could be tough. But I think back to your point about valuation, you know, these are valuations that we last saw in the financial crisis of 08-09. And back to the point, our banking industry is in very good health. It's not overly geared, it has loads of capital, they have strong balance sheets. And the amount of money supply in the market, if you like, you know, when you go through a normal credit supply, the banks and everyone else gets overly excited, they lend to people that don't have the financial resilience. you've got to remember, over the last decade, the banks have been forced to have very strict rules about affordability and lending criteria. And as a result of that, I think the market can take for a short period of time these very high interest rates. But it's not a case of us having to work through all of that lending, which was too loose, you know, too easy. And in actual fact, as interest rates start to fall, then the credit cycle will be relatively shallow, and banks will be happy to come back and lend to people as we move back into 2024. So yeah. I think there is a bit of a danger. We didn't actually have a recession at the start of this year. I think there is a danger we have a very shallow recession at the back end of this year. But again, the danger is that you get overly bearish about this, and to the point of, it's more around the absolute value of individual businesses now at extreme lows versus the direction of travel. And so, yes, look, you know, I have a little bit of a nervousness about some of those domestic companies that are linked in to the housing market. But again, you know, I don't want to get too bearish, because I'm not going to see this set of opportunities probably for the rest of my career. And probably I've only seen once or maybe twice in my career so far. So it is that old cliche, you know, be greedy when other people are fearful. And we're just going through another period where, you know, I think there's an awful lot of opportunity if you can be measured about looking at some of those short-term issues in the UK economy.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I think if you're right, and the Bank of England does start to sort of like, you know, reduce interest rates next year, the market will anticipate that sort of 6 months earlier, as it did at the end of the great financial crisis, because small caps bottomed towards the sort of back end of 2008, not when the FTSE bottomed, which was the March 2009. So it was at least six months earlier. So you could actually see, even though if we go through a recession, you could actually see small caps do okay as they're the first sort of like, you know, triggered inflection point coming out.
Well, I mean, I think even if we have a difficult second half, you're likely to see the last sort of downgrades coming through as we start the autumn. And if you look back historically, because we've small and mid-cap have been underperforming for about five quarters, they've actually stopped underperforming, which is what we'd said they'd do at the end of Q1. So even with this outlook, I mean, I think prices could be volatile, but I don't think they're going to materially underperform. And if you try and second guess it to be too clever, you're going to miss the big upside. And as you're right, when the market finally decide we've had the last downgrade, because valuations are so low, share prices move very, very quickly. Yeah. And so, yes, I think, you know, we over the summer will be very measured about slowly taking advantage of some very, very good opportunities. And really the expectation that at some point in the autumn, that really is the low for UK equities. And we know, even though money is now harder to borrow from a private equity or corporate point of view, we know there's a lot of interest in UK businesses that are quoted on the market because they show such great value. And I expect as we move over the summer and actually earlier into the autumn, there are some people who know you have to go early. And we're going to see some more bids of businesses, which are, you know, a once in a decade opportunity to buy some amazing value.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Now, just one thing which has cropped up in the first half is artificial intelligence, regenerative AI. What's your sort of like initial views here? Because it's sort of like it's going to, you could get quite a bipolar type of, you know, market. You get some sort of some good winners, but equally some losers. How are you sort of thinking about that in terms of sort of like overlaying in your investment sort of horizon?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, obviously it's I mean, AI has been building in the background quite substantially. A lot of our investments use AI to make themselves more efficient, more productive, create better products and services for their customers. So it's not new. I think it's just the fact that OpenAI and ChatGPT has really exploded AI onto the world. Mm. And everyone's now fascinated about some of the things it can do. And some of the things it can do are really quite incredible. But I think you have to think that AI doesn't have long arms. So effectively, it can't distribute product. It can't actually deliver services. Mm. And, you know, it's sort of at the moment, people are sort of almost, you know, speculating about what OpenAI, what artificial intelligence will do for the world over the next 30 years. And the an expectation that it'll all happen in the next couple of quarters. What we know from experience of technology adoption, this is the part of the cycle we call the hype cycle. Mm. So everyone gets very, very excited. And there are some businesses that we expect to benefit from, you know, early adoption of AI. It wasn't really early adoption. It was already happening in the backdrop. But a lot of the things that people are discussing and worried about aren't actually going to materialize for 10 to 20 years. Mm. So, you know, there has been some talk about software, and now actually, can you actually program computers by just talking to them? Now, I think, you know, in my lifetime, we will get some way towards that. And certainly in my children's lifetime, the way we develop software will change materially as a result of AI. But I think we're a long, long way from us materially worrying about some of the software companies we invest in as a result of AI adoption. I think there's a lot also about ownership of creative property. So there are businesses like Future, where there's been a lot of concern. Future obviously owns magazine, or whether now online publications like Tech Radar, T3, these are sort of technology reviews, but also sort of homes, lifestyle products.
The share price has been battered, hasn't it? It's really come down hard on those fears.
Will suddenly be able to recreate all of that. The thing is that it's not just a case of you providing that information. It's also providing information that is correct for you. Mm. Now, the one thing that people can't do at the moment is give ChatGPT a lot of information about themselves. And there's a lot of concern about that, around security, and I don't think that's going to happen. So, you know, OpenAI has said that they won't handle medical data and they won't handle financial data. And also they won't deal in data about you. So it's all good typing in and looking for, say, I don't know, a children's bike. Mm. But I think understanding that you want a children's bike and your child is this age and they've cycled before, you know, you need to collect a lot of information before you can really deliver really good answers. And then the second point is about the delivery and the mechanism that Google's business model works on is obviously about linking that to people who are selling products, goods, and really the future platform allows all of that to happen in a very seamless and very integrated way. Now, ChatGPT and OpenAI doesn't create that for you. It doesn't create that platform. So there will be some changes to the front end, but I think it's probably going to be immaterial. And as a result, the market's concern about some of these things will play out. And because it's being democratized very, very quickly, I think it will play out very, very quickly. So I think by Christmas, a lot of these businesses that have really been impacted by concerns around AI will really have moved on. And people have realized that those business models are not going to change overnight.
Yeah. Well, I would highlight to investors the shares of Future currently trade at less than 5x PE, which is just frankly suggesting that it's going to be broken, isn't it? It's a broken model, which, as you rightly point out, you know.
Well, I think it's a combination of those concerns, but also the outlook for the UK and US consumer. So, yeah. Again, you know, you pile on just the cyclical effects and you pile on more worry about some structural changes because of AI and people get very, very nervous. But again, this goes back to the point of, you know, there is a lot of opportunity. And as again, we've seen technology adoption many times, and it is human nature that we overestimate the short-term impact of technology and we massively underestimate its long-term impact.
Yeah, yeah. And there's plenty of blood on the streets at the moment in Future. There's no doubt about it. Rivers of blood, I think. In terms of some shares which have done, you know, pretty well, or certainly the trading doing pretty well, is the fintech sort of Forex challenger brands. We've got Argentex and Equals. And I think the last trading update they both did at their AGMs or their prelims, they were sort of like year-to-date trading was, I think it was about 35% up for Argentex and about 40-odd% up for like-for-like sales at Equals. Do you want to take us through your latest view here? Because with the volatility we've seen with interest rates, I mean, Sterling's been bouncing up and down like Zebedee of late, and it's got to help these guys, you'd have thought.
Well, I think certainly, I mean, there are two quite different business models in what is, you know, a vast space of the fintech market. And I think that's why it's so interesting, because as banking changes, again, to the point of, you know, fintechs really are starting to adopt and deploy new technology that really came about from, you know, the internet becoming all pervasive. But, you know, we're decades on and we're now slowly to build these new models. I mean, I think Argentex, you know, is primarily putting in place hedging strategies and currency transactions for corporates. And that's a huge market. And historically, it's been served by the big clearing banks across the world. And they haven't tended to do it very well, especially for SMEs. Mm-hmm. And Argentex has been slowly building a very strong team, but also a technology distribution model that's allowing them to scale the business, as well as entry into new markets. And they set up an office in Australia. They've set up an office in Amsterdam to access European markets. And there is a lot of pent-up demand for, you know, FX services, transactional services that are done in a far better way, either because of automation or because of a better personalized one-on-one service. And that's really why that business is able to grow. Now, yes, you know, FX volatility really helps, because if you're the finance director of a business and you're looking at trying to manage that volatility, either as you're buying some of your input goods, or you're looking to make sure you're fixing the prices of products that you've sold into European or US markets, you need to manage your treasury operations. And Argentex helps and allows you to do that far more effectively and at a lower cost than the clearing banks might provide that to you. So really, there's an open door for that business to grow, even in difficult economic markets. And as you say, you know, their business really is more exposed to the volatility of those markets rather than necessarily the GDP growth globally or of the UK. Yeah. Equals is a different business, really, in that Equals is almost outsourcing business operations that are linked to international payments. And international payments, again, is poorly served by the big clearing banks, but it's also managing large numbers of people in your business who have got, you know, payment cards or are making payments. So think of industries like film production or sports clubs, but also businesses that have got relatively complex reconciliation, like the IFA market and financial services. And Equals really have put in place a very scalable platform. All of that architecture and plumbing is actually very difficult to do. And really, if you compare it, the other businesses that have the same capability set are much, much larger than Equals, which is why I think that business certainly has sustained very strong growth and is investing for the future. And they bought a European business a quarter or so ago. Obviously, they're waiting for EU approval. We would hope that would come sooner rather than later. And then that accesses, that opens up another large market for them. And again, this is really around industries adopting fintech and much more efficient ways of banking than they have done historically. So as a result of the very, very strong growth in a vast, relatively steady state market, hopefully those businesses continue to grow, even if, you know, the economic outlook for Europe, the UK and the US looks relatively difficult.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right in terms of sort of like, you know, they've got secular tailwinds, they're winning market share from sort of, you know, the mainstream banks. They have these platforms that they're, you know, taking out internationally, et cetera. And the sales are doing, you know, they're growing really strongly. But the shares have just sort of flatlined, even though the fundamentals are so much, hence gives you that sort of like, you know, investors to have a look at for opportunity, certainly. Because
yeah, I mean, I think in the short term, where we're in a difficult market, where we've seen performance this year, I mean, earnings momentum is always a powerful driver of share price performance. And, you know, I think it will continue to be this year, especially in a difficult market. And we've seen some of those names, such as Equals, and there are others in the portfolio like Kitwave, have had very strong earnings momentum and upgrades over the last 12, 18 months. Yeah. And, you know, certainly there's a lot of concern out there, and we can't be certain that they're going to continue to upgrade, but certainly, you know, in the markets they operate, there are reasons why, because they're taking market share, because people will still adopt these services even in a difficult marketplace, that those companies have the potential to potentially continue that trend.
Just turning now to sort of like healthcare, which is another sector with huge secular growth trends, demographics and new technology. And one I've never really come across is Oxford Biomedica, which I believe sort of like teamed up with AstraZeneca to do their vaccine production at one stage, and are now sort of like pivoted into gene therapy and have come up with a mechanism that allows drug or biotech businesses to put sort of therapeutic properties into genes, which is a really tough area. So do you want to take us through your latest view on Biomedica? Because it's a fascinating business.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is a really fascinating business. I mean, they effectively manufactured a lot of the AstraZeneca vaccine in the UK. Some of it was made in India, but some of that supply chain was in the UK. And that did really help Oxford Biomedica. But as you say, you know, if you went back to sort of 2017, 2018, there were a lot of the US and global players in the space were looking to develop gene therapies. And this is effectively where you infuse people with effectively a sort of an altered virus that effectively then basically attacks the cancer in your body. But to do that, you need to produce a large amount of these very complex viruses that are altered in the right way. The main product that's on the market at the moment is Pfizer's Chimera, which is being used very, very successfully to treat cancers. I think the interesting thing is there's sort of two platforms of methodology of creating these viruses. And Oxford Biomedica bought a business in the US that effectively allows it to have all of the potential platforms for manufacturing of these therapies. Now, there's been quite a lot of difficulty for the biotechs in reliably and efficiently and at a good low cost producing these cell therapies. And Oxford Biomedica has proven that they have the capability and the technology set to actually manufacture them. So they've got a lot of capacity globally, world-class capacity in Oxford in the UK, but also in the US now. And they're getting a lot of interest from the main producers of gene therapies for Oxford Biomedica to produce those. I think the frustrating thing in the market at the moment is that this business during the period of COVID was highly cash generative and quite profitable because it was doing that contract for Astra. Well, that Astra contract is now dropping away and you're replacing all of that in this commercial work. This is spread across lots of different therapies, which is great from a risk point of view, because if one of those therapies is not successful, you now have dozens of potential therapies that will be produced by Oxford Biomedica. The business is sort of, it's just teetering. So we tend not to invest in loss-making businesses. And it's at that point where it's just the wrong side of being loss-making. But essentially, as this business ramps up, the drop through, because you know there's a lot of fixed costs of all of this manufacturing space, then the operational gearing should be very, very powerful. And if you look to the potential sales that the business could generate, then, you know, if it can deliver operationally, then these shares are very, very good value in an area, as you said, of potentially great secular growth. And the interesting thing that we try to do when we invest in small companies, you know, obviously we're investing in the UK market, but obviously we're looking at the competitive dynamics globally. And Oxford Biomedica has, with the acquisition it made in the US near Boston and its operations in the UK, has an incredibly strong structural positioning in the market.
Yeah, and you would wonder... Well, you'd think anyway. I mean, with a market cap of only, what, £425 million, you'd have thought, actually, that's a real lovely bite size for some sort of like M&A from overseas buyer. You know, they could probably pay twice that value and still make huge amounts of return. So if they've got that treasure trove of IPR with gene therapy, that is hugely valuable, particularly if it was part of a much larger organization that could really leverage it quickly. So yeah, certainly one to watch. Now, another one in the healthcare, which is really helping the NHS, is Totally. Wendy Lawrence, the CEO there, and they do sort of the 111 service, but also sort of insourcing, which is sort of like helping the NHS do elective procedures, etc. And the shares have crazily have been sold off. But what's your sort of latest view on Totally?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Wendy's done an amazing job with that business. You know, they had to get through the COVID period, which is really, really difficult. Obviously, for some of their services like 911, you know, there was a lot of demand. But the problem was around elective surgery because of, you know, stop starting and delays. Yeah. And they've done a really good job about trying to create additional capacity to work through the huge backlogs that the NHS is facing. And, you know, a lot of the hospital authorities are really valuing those services. So, you know, Totally is not trying to compete with the NHS. It's trying to be complementary and provide additional capacity and also reduce bottlenecks in certain areas of sort of emergency services within the healthcare system. So they had a short-term issue this year where, you know, there was a decision to end a contract with one of the hospital authorities, and that was for, you know, as far as I understand, very specific reasons. But I think the broad trends are very much in Totally's favour, and the UK, you know, we need capacity within the NHS to get through the backlog of elective surgeries. I mean, back to the earlier point that we made around, you know, where the reduction in the labour pool in the UK, everyone always cites, you know, the early retirement of people or Brexit. The reality is the biggest loss of the labour pool is from people who are long-term sick. So yeah, you know, Totally has a very strong position in that market, and we expect to see, we would hope, if they can continue to deliver, that they'll continue to win more contracts across that marketplace.
Yeah, with a PE of less than 5.5 and cash on the balance sheet, that looks extraordinarily good value.
Well, I feel like that's the new norm in lots of areas, you know. Figure five, you have to go back to the 1970s before you kind of really feel that's the sort of in a lot of sectors, a lot of companies, that's normalized valuation.
Yeah, well, coming to sort of like another sector, software. Now, we talked obviously a bit about AI, and all these seem to maybe potential beneficiaries. Let's start with ActiveOps, which does sort of like automation software for sort of the large banks, insurance company back offices, and it helps sort of like them sort of, you know, manage the resource, both their offices and hybrid working in a more efficient manner, etc. And I think they've got their results coming out fairly soon. In fact, I think next week or so. And they had an update a couple of months back saying they were trading in line. I think, in fact, sales have grown up about 10% per annum. Do you want to take us through your latest view here? Because they do seem to be moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got some really good products, which, as you say, you know, this is around managing scheduling and workloads within banks. And that's become harder as you've got hybrid working. So you've got a fragmented workforce. And you're trying to manage peaks and troughs in terms of, you know, their customer demand, and make sure people have got the right hours and that's linked together. And obviously, if you can get that to work, you can make yourself much, much more efficient. So we've seen over time, you know, global banks adopting their products, right, like regionally and slowly growing regionally, but also the different product sets that they've got that do sort of different components of effectively, you know, making your workforce more efficient. And I'm sure AI, AI models plug into making those software products more efficient. I think one of the problems for ActiveOps is just, you know, again, in a bear market, you know, that business is very well run, but it's been run at sort of roughly around break even. And that's because they want to invest in growth. So they've been, you know, primarily investing in sales and marketing to grow the top line. And also it's a high quality revenue stream. You know, most of the revenues of this business are ARR, they're recurring revenues. And the market really hasn't given the benefit, the company the benefit of that, but because it's about break even. If the business wanted to be profitable, it could be highly profitable today. And it's got a strong balance sheet. So we're not worried about all of that. But as I say, you know, even in a bear market, most sort of software businesses are trading on sort of 5x their enterprise value, their debt plus their equity to their revenues. And that's only really applicable if you have very high quality customers and they're signing long-term recurring agreements, which is really where ActiveOps sits. Now, you know, ActiveOps at the moment, I think it's probably trading at sort of 1.5x EV to sales.
Yeah, that's right.
So there is a big disconnect between a lot of the other models in the market and where that sits. And really, the structure of the business doesn't necessarily justify that discount. But I think really, that's because we're in a bear market. It's a small company. And as I said, it's around break even. And people like to see these businesses generating good margins. But, you know, we would expect, if they can deliver on what they've laid out in their strategy, that we would expect the profitability to obviously grow from here.
Another one is sort of like a bit of a stealth AI play is FD Technologies, which was the old First Derivatives business. It's got sort of three divisions. It's got the KX Insights, which does the sort of mass real-time data processing, largely in the capital markets, but they're putting into other verticals. It's got the sort of the capital markets consultancy IT business, and then obviously it's got the MRP with them advertising, which has been struggling of late. Do you want to give us your latest thoughts on this? Because you know, you'd think with the KX Insight business, it could be a real engine for growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I mean, KX, I mean, the FD tech's been around for a long time. So helping the major banks of the world deliver, you know, analysis of huge data sets that they collect in a real time basis for many of their functions, sort of trading functions across the banks. And KX is a sort of a novel language that allows you to analyze time series data and make those databases operate in a very efficient way. But that's a relatively niche market. And they really delivered that as a service. So KX would have, or FD Technologies would have, people within a bank, Morgan Stanley's of this world, JP Morgan's, delivering these services. Now, that's, you know, it was a very strong business. But it was interesting. They wanted, a bit like ChatGPT, they wanted to basically, you know, put this into the wider open market. Mm. The problem is, to program in KX, you need to have learned a very quirky language.
Oh, right, okay.
There only are thousands of people in the world who know how to program in this. So what the business did was they went and basically created a toolkit that means that you can program in SQL or Python. Now, Python is the language of data analytics, and there are tens of millions of people globally who program in Python and SQL. So that was what the first thing in terms of making it much, much more available. The second thing was actually putting it onto the Microsoft Azure and AWS platforms. So this means if I'm a semiconductor manufacturer and I want to do this real-time data analysis, I can now use my Azure platform or my AWS platform to host KX, and my programmers can be doing those programming in Python to collect the data that's coming off all of my machines. So it's not just now in the financial markets. It's caught across lots of different industrial verticals, including drug development and semis. And the final point I would say is that as we move into AI, we've all heard about NVIDIA and NVIDIA's share price going through the roof because of this.
It's only 25 times my sales.
For graphics processing capability, graphics processing chips rather than CPUs. And this is where you're processing in a graphics-based way, which is much more efficient. Now, KX can be used to do vector-based processing, which is effectively a much, much more efficient way of querying databases. So ultimately, you can do it 100 times faster for a tenth of the cost.
Right.
So it's a thousandfold increase in your productivity. And you can start doing all of this dialed up through Azure almost instantly. And with a huge shortage of GPU chips, the ability to do vector-based processing is a huge opportunity. So this is no longer in the relatively smaller world of time series databases, which might be, you know, potentially a couple of billion of market opportunity. This is a 30 to 40 billion market opportunity. And it's interesting, the fact you've signed up partnerships, or the business has signed up partnerships with AWS, with Microsoft and Azure, and Snowflake, which is a $50 billion database unification sort of business to streamline your databases. There are reasons for that. And I think that marketplace is going to grow very, very strongly. And we would expect KX to benefit in some of that growth. And this, you know, the business has been growing at over 40% over the last 12 months in what has been quite a difficult market for corporate spending. So again, you know, where we talked about those other fintech businesses, you know, we think there are big drivers for companies to adopt this technology because of the cost savings that you're going to gain from it. And you've made it very easy for them to adopt this technology. It's not a case of you having to spend a load of money on hardware or changing your processes to start to be able to use it.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fascinating. I've been sort of like following the company and not understood the vector side of it. So that's brilliant insight.
Well, I have to speak to our data analysts here to basically try to understand some of the technology, but it is really powerful stuff, and they certainly get very excited about it.
Another one which is sort of like the shares have sold off a bit is Blanco, which does sort of like data erasure. And you'd have thought it, I think it's done quite well with all the sort of laptops and PCs were sold during the pandemic as we were all in lockdown and started now having to be cleaned up with it. So they can sell it to sort of iTads and they obviously mobile devices. And they're trying to get into sort of the live environment as well to be able to allow customers and clients to delete data in a sort of like a, you know, a real time basis, etc. What's your sort of latest view here? Because it's sort of really sort of like industry standard technology, but it's obviously seemed to be getting a bit more competitive in that sector.
Yeah, I you know, Blanco's a lovely little business. Mm. Interesting, this morning they just got their carbon neutral accreditation again.
Mm.
So, you know, this really is a green stock of the tech space.
Yeah.
If you think about all of the servers, and not just, you know, the ones that we have sitting under our desks, but, you know, you think about the big Amazon and Microsoft, you know, server farms, all of those servers, if you can't wipe all of that data cleanly, effectively, they're all being crushed up and recycled. So if you can try and create a bit more of a closed loop and have better data integrity, because you can have real confidence that those servers are being cleaned of any customer data or commercial data that would be incredibly sensitive. I think the interesting thing for Blanco, it does operate in sort of three different discrete markets. Mm. And some of those markets are very competitive. Mobile is very competitive. Mm. And I think what's been sort of masked for that business over time is natural fact, the enterprise space. So this is cleaning up corporate servers, and it has been growing very, very dramatically. And there's a huge demand for that. And Blanco basically does it faster, cheaper, more secure, with a better audit process than anyone else. And they have patents around that. Mm. And that's growing very, very nicely. The mobile business is fine, but it's been a bit cyclical. And there's also an ITAD business, which effectively is doing sort of consumer boxes. And that marketplace is being consolidated. And I think as we go over time, that enterprise business will really continue to grow and will become the majority of the business. Mm. And I think it will be much clearer to people that is really where most of the value creation is coming from in Blanco. So I think it's at a really nice inflection point, and there is huge market demand. And as again, the great thing about it is it's got very strong green credentials, because effectively you're recycling hardware that otherwise would have to go into landfill, or we've all seen the horror shows of some of this material ending up in emerging markets where there's sort of, you know, backyard recycling of some pretty dangerous and toxic materials.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, cybercrime's going nowhere, and likewise, regulation GDPR is only tightening, isn't it? So those are big secular tailwinds for what it does. I know we touched on it earlier, the house builders and the housing market. You've got Crest Nicholson, and frankly, I just cannot believe how cheap the share is. I looked at the book value, and it's about sort of like £3.40, £3.50 per share. And I told her this morning, the shares are currently less than £2. It's sort of like, something's got to give. It just seems ridiculous.
Well, I mean, but, you know, at this point in the market, as I said, you know, the market looks at direction of travel rather than absolute value. And there is a huge amount of absolute value sitting in Crest Nicholson.
Yeah.
But the direction of travel is more difficult. You know, people are waiting to see how the autumn season goes in terms of housing sales, but also house prices. And, you know, certainly the worst end of the scenario, there is a danger that house prices fall further than we expect, and the margins of someone like a Crest Nicholson get impacted. If you can look beyond 12 months, then obviously there is a huge amount of value, because you know, every single economic cycle in the UK, you know, the housing market has come back incredibly strongly because of all of the long-term trends in terms of a shortage of housing, a shortage of land, a very long and protracted planning process. Yeah. And Crest Nicholson's an incredibly well-run business where, you know, the management have come in and sorted out the business, standardized the products, made sure they're right sizes, the number of sites they're operating, how well those sites are functioning, and how well the houses are put together. So I think none of that's changed. And that's still the opportunity for ultimately in the next cycle, much better margins. If you wanted me to say, where do I think Crest Nicholson's margins will bottom out at the end of this year? I would be foolhardy to try and, one, I'm not going to predictions on this call, but I would be foolhardy to try and do so. But I think what you do know is that the business is in a strong enough place from a balance sheet point of view that it will be able to look through that. And once you come out the other side, you can see some very substantial value creation.
Yeah, I think a lot of investors, you mentioned it obviously on the bank side, they're a lot healthier than they were in the great financial crisis of 2008, 2009. It's likewise actually with the house builders. And I think probably subconsciously, a lot of investors have got this PTSD, you know, sort of syndrome at the back of their mind that house builders really suffered. But most of them have got absolutely rock solid balance sheets. So, and Chris Nicholson's got plenty of cash on there as well. So I'm with you. As long as you have a long-term time horizon, then that business should certainly have its day. Now, just moving on to, again, a topical area is defense with Chemring. And that's got a sort of like a nice cybersecurity angle with its Roke business, but obviously does flares and sort of decoys as well for sort of like helicopters. And we have the news obviously over the weekend with what's been happening in Russia, potential coups. What's your sort of latest view on Chemring? Because it's obviously been a good performer.
Yeah, I mean, it's got two quite distinct businesses, as you say. They make countermeasures, which are to protect pilots in planes if missiles are fired at them. They also have some fairly unique businesses where they make the sort of ignition, the sort of the dangerous bit of ejector seats. Mm. So if you think, you know, you're a pilot and you're relying on Chemrings, basically explosives that will, you know, take you clear of the plane.
So quite important, really.
If I was flying a fast jet, I'd want to know that Chemring's products are going to work. Agreed. But also the longer term growth area of space exploration, whether that be sort of low Earth satellites or SpaceX programs. So that they have a business in Norway and also in North America that makes explosives for those. And it's a niche market, but it's also very, very difficult for anyone to get into. You need to be, you know, doing this for a long time. Safety is really, really critical, and they're very, very focused on the safety of their people, which, you know, going back a few decades was certainly an issue. Now that business is incredibly well run. I guess the more exciting areas of business they've got called Roke. Now Roke really is doing some really very clever stuff on cybersecurity. So a lot for the likes of GCHQ, but also US customers. Now, even the board doesn't necessarily know exactly what they're doing, but imagine sort of
James Bond.
Good hackers, cybersecurity, and that business is growing. And really, I mean, you know, I think there is a lot of opportunity over the next few years for the demand in the market for them to continue to grow that. Now, they originally were focused on the defense market because of their heritage. But they've also seen with the rise of cybercrime that there's a huge demand in the commercial space. And so they've started to productize what their capability set was within Roke to allow commercial companies to use their products and their expertise to protect them from, you know, what is going to be a continued and growing amount of cybercrime around the world. So, yeah, it's a nice little business in some interesting areas. But again, also it's in defense. But really, it's you know, it's there to protect people either from the virtual threat or, you know, for our armed forces in terms of actual, you know, physical threat.
Is there an unbundling play there at all to sort of like separate the two divisions?
I don't think it's anything that, you know, the business would necessarily consider in the short term. Yes, I guess you could argue what is the real benefit of the two businesses being together. I think they are markets with sort of similar aligned drivers. So, you know, it's possible at some point in the future. Yeah. I think it's anything on the cards at the moment.
Yeah. And also you've got to look at the tax leakage potential. If you've grown Roke from scratch, then there's probably a big sort of capital gain you're probably going to get hit by. But anyway, they'd have to structure all that properly. Yeah. Now, just turning to sort of industrials and similar sort of like, you know, mission critical activities. We've got Avingtrans. I know we've talked about this one before, but the shares, even though it's a small cap, have been rock solid. And they do sort of like, you know, sort of safety boxes for Sellafield for storage, low level nuclear waste. They also do these blast proof doors for HS2. And they've got, you know, energy pumps and all this sort of stuff. But also they've got the healthcare side, the Magnetica. What's your sort of latest here? Because I think they do have some results coming out fairly soon as well.
Mm. Well, I think, I mean, again, you know, as you say, they have some really interesting niche industrial businesses in some weird and wonderful areas, such as you'd never imagine, blast doors on HS2, and as you said, Sellafield. And those companies ultimately very high quality, building very long term order books with those customers. Nice little businesses. And remember, you know, they talk about pies. They like pies.
So, oh, that's right.
And so this is all about, you know, buying businesses, improving them, and, you know, at the end of the day, looking to if they'd be better off with new owners, with larger companies. And we expect them to continue to recycle that capital. And there are some businesses that are getting towards that sort of maturer phase because they've improved the quality of the businesses. They've built up the order book. And certainly at some point we would expect, you know, following that strategy that they will dispose of some of those businesses. The healthcare part of the business, as you say, Magnetica, is in some very interesting areas of imaging. I mean, the biggest opportunity is really in small size, small section MRI. Mm. So many listeners will have been in an MRI machine in a hospital setting. You know, it's in its own room. It's a massive, great machine. It's got a separate sort of, you know, control room. And all of that infrastructure costs a lot of money. And you obviously, you know, potentially are being put in the whole of this machine all the way. Now, there are obviously lots of people suffer from injuries to their wrists, their elbows, their knees, their ankles. And you would still go if you were really suffering and you, you know, doctors or clinicians really need to see what's going on. You would have to go in a full MRI, which is quite a big cost. Now, a small sort of format MRI, sort of, you know, I don't know, the size of a limb can obviously take your arm, your leg and do that imaging at a much, much lower cost than having a big MRI. But there's also another adjacent, very growing market of companion pets. And obviously these MRI scanners are big enough to put a cat or a dog through and is on a much, much lower cost. So the potential for the veterinary market to adopt this MRI scanner. Now, we're waiting for approval at the back end of this year, but it is obviously a huge market. And they also do have some 3D imaging, which has already been approved, which is another additional sort of imaging market that they can take advantage of. And I, you know, I think there's not an awful lot assumed in the equity value of that business for the potential of those medical companies. So there's some nice diversification across there. And again, also, you know, where you're doing a lot of work for either big infrastructure projects or the nuclear market or healthcare, you're very economically resilient. So yeah. I'm not saying that there aren't some businesses in Avingtrans that have some economic sensitivity, but the vast majority of Avingtrans revenues are what we would term sort of economically resilient.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about sort of 30-35% of just of the sales are even tied to nuclear, for instance. So yeah, I mean, that's huge secular growth trends, no doubt about it. Another one in the industrial sector that came out some good, very good results is Discover IE, which I've never really gone into in great deal, but they do sort of like niche electrical sort of parts, which go into game mission critical activities. And I think they're growing well and they're good margins.
Yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant little business. I mean, it's in some ways comparable to Diploma, which now sits in the FTSE 100. And I remember Diploma was just really 100 million market cap at the start of my career. And Discover IE, I think, has a similar sort of path and opportunity to go on. You know, it effectively is buying businesses that manufacture mission-critical electromagnetic components that are good margins, but they might sit in a particular geography, the Nordics, Germany, the US, the UK. And really their ability to go and distribute those products globally is quite difficult. If you become part of a bigger group, you then have the strengths of being part of a larger company. But the way that they structure the business is they don't want to destroy that entrepreneurialism and centralize everything. So they allow all of these businesses to have autonomy. And that works incredibly well for the companies. And they're not particularly capital intensive, but quite often they've been relatively capital starved as private companies. So if you invest a small amount of capital into them, you can really get some very strong returns and paybacks. And there is a very large market to consolidate. You know, this has historically been a very, very fragmented market. So we expect that, you know, the business is in areas where these components that are being deployed into medical, renewables, other areas of secular growth in different technologies. So there is this really nice tailwind, but also this really powerful business model that's got some very high returns, and therefore it generates a lot of free cash flow.
Yeah. Another one which has got sort of like great revenue visibility and sort of like, you know, growing order books is in the aerospace, is Senior. What's your sort of latest view? Because obviously everything was locked down during the pandemic. And it was sort of like also, I think, was tied to some of the Boeing problems as well with some of its, you know, I can't remember what is it.
Well, it was the 737 MAX, which obviously had, you know, tragically had some fatal crashes. And that caused some problems. It had a lot of ships set on the 737 MAX. But as you say, I think aerospace is very interesting because there is long-term growth in the aerospace market. And there are some things that the aerospace industry has to get over in terms of its carbon intensity. But I think there are, you know, there are very significant investments going on to get over that hurdle. But generally, as we get global population growth and the emerging markets of Asia, you know, slowly get wealthier, there is a desire and need for labor to travel around and move more. And that's why, you know, historically we've had very consistent long-term growth ahead of global GDP in the aerospace sector. And as you said, you know, that sector during COVID, pointing out the obvious, ground to so yeah. The aerospace cycle is completely out of step with the rest of the economic cycle. So yeah. We're just in an upswing. And because there are very strict regulations about manufacturing components within the supply chain for aerospace, quite rightly, I would not want to be getting on a plane to somebody who'd just been employed to manufacture parts to sort of expand the supply base. You know, you've had to be a supplier that's been accredited, that's taken, you know, many, many years. And as a result, the supply chain to the aerospace industry sort of dials up very, very slowly. And as a result, the supply is being constrained, and that supply is slowly building, but there's huge demand because the demand has been running ahead of that supply. So you have this really nice situation where you can see very long-term demand from high-quality customers, and the supply is slowly building. And senior, during the last cycle, obviously you get different plane platforms. They're all becoming more efficient. And it spent a lot of time, a lot of money being designed into those platforms. And you're in those platforms for the life of the platform.
Yeah.
And some of these platforms are 25 to 30 years. So you can argue you've got 25 to 30 years broad visibility on your sales numbers. And I think at the moment, the market hasn't really recognized, one, the quality of the revenue stream out of their aerospace business and how much that will slowly build over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think it's if you want to go for sort of like a, I mean, it's difficult to call anything, but it's sort of like a widow's and orphan stock. Aerospace is a pretty good sector to look at the moment with those forward order books. Another one in the sort of the industrial side is Essentra, which again I haven't really looked at. I think it's a sort of like a niche sort of plastic injection molding type of business that that makes very good margins. Actually, I was looking at it; it's sort of like nearly 13% EBIT margin. So it's obviously got some IPR there.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think of the right word for the products it makes. It's sort of that thing that you kind of you probably find in a drawer at home. But imagine it from a commercial level. So, you know, anything like you're making engines for cars, and where, as they come off the line, you need to put a little plastic cap on one of the things so you don't get dust and grime in there. And it might only be that big, but it has to be exactly the right size to fit that hole. And that's the sort of thing Essentra makes. And you think there is huge numbers of applications where you just need these little bits of things. Generally, they're made of some kind of plastic. That they need to be made. They need to be distributed. And they make about 50-60% of their products. But these are all quite, some are standardized, some are specialists. But they're all these little components that are needed in these industrial areas. And really, the business has gone through a point of modernization to actually understand what its customers, it's usually called an ERP system, an enterprise-wide planning system. And it's been through a lot of those pains to modernize the business, invest in the company. So it's now in a position where it can really leverage off that investment that it's made to serve those markets. And a lot of those markets are served by small regional businesses that haven't made that similar level of investment. But again, it's highly cash generative. These are in little quirky niches that aren't that competitive. And there is a lot of opportunity for growth, which means that, you know, the overall global GDP has less of an influence on the business. Of course, it does have an influence, but it has less of an influence on the business than it does. And a lot of people haven't looked at it because they used to own a cigarette filters business. And because it owned a cigarette filters business, it was pretty much off everyone's radar because of the harmful effects of tobacco. Now, it sold that business. So that's also helped in giving the company a good balance sheet for potential accretive M&A. But as a result, I think it's, you know, it's one of those businesses being overlooked by people as a result of how it used to be structured.
Yeah, it looks like good, strong niche positions there. I mean, to generate, say, 13% EBIT margins in that industry is absolutely, you know, very good. Now, and the one which is a counter-cyclical play, which came out with some results last week, is Man Olay, which is, I think, is the UK's sort of like number one insolvency litigation sort of, you know, provider and funder, etc. And it's obviously went through a bit of an up and down during the pandemic because the government stopped insolvencies happening in sort of like, you know, to stop stop companies going bust. And now, obviously, we're normalizing. And their results, actually, they were saying they're seeing some pretty good uptick just of late as those, you know, as the market and the industry catches up with a lot of the backlog.
Yeah. I mean, I think Manley is a really interesting business, but it's quite, in one way, it's quite complicated. In another way, it's not that complicated. And I try and keep it simple because otherwise I get very confused. So, you know, I think making sure we collect undue payments when someone goes into insolvency, mainly tax that hasn't been paid, is very important to keep an efficient marketplace. And the difference of Manolet's business model is that in that area, most law firms would basically be hard on an hourly rate. And really, they don't have a huge incentive to basically settle as quickly as possible or as efficiently as possible, because they're on an hourly rate. So, you know, I'm very happy I'm getting paid. Manolet actually buys the cases. And therefore, if they settle the case as quickly as they can, it's in their best interest. Now, generally, we're not massively keen on balance sheet businesses. But the great thing about Manolet is it's just getting to a point where the balance sheet will become less important, because they actually settle these cases incredibly quickly with incredibly high return. So on average, they settle these cases just over 12 months, which is great, because you're cycling the cash in a financial year. And the second point is that the rate of return, the internal rate of return, is about over 120%. So you're getting a very high return on that capital, and that capital has got a relatively short duration in the system. And obviously, as you get to a certain size, the cash generation occurring in the business will be enough to fund your growth. And we're really just getting to that tipping point. And I think it's a very interesting business, because it's the only business that deploys this model. I think this model has been seen by several practitioners in that world, which is quite a niche sort of, you know, interesting area, that this is theoretically the most effective model. But it's really the main player, and it's the player that's got scale. And you need scale, because you need enough work and you need enough practitioners, a very specialized area of expertise, to be working for you. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think as we go through this normalization process of insolvencies, the business has a lot of opportunity to take market share in what is basically a much more optimal service to ultimately, you know, to a great extent, Her Majesty's Treasury for unpaid tax.
Yeah. And I think they've also got that bounce back loans program. They're helping one of the banks, I think it's Barclays.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, we'll have to see how it develops. They've kind of, you know, we're meeting the company next week. Maybe they'll start to tell us more. But yes, they've certainly, there's a lot of bounce back loans that were incorrectly and haven't been paid back. And so that's a huge pool of capital and potential opportunity for them.
Yeah. Well, he was in good positive mood, I think, last week, the CEO, Stephen Cooklin. So we'll wait to hear what happens there. Now, just a couple of small micro caps. And one was going through another inflection point turnaround, been through a financing, is Techmar, which is basically it does sort of like, again, niche connectors for offshore sort of wind farms and the offshore oil and gas industry. And like, you know, not surprisingly, I suppose, there's a lot more activity in the oil and gas sector in the North Sea, but equally with the sort of the you know, the offshore wind, with the sort of Dogger wind farm there, I mean, that's going like gangbuster. So what's your latest view on this sort of really quite niche specialist business?
Well, I think, I mean, one of the problems with Techmar is because it was such a small company in a huge market.
Yeah.
And there's huge amounts of opportunity, but there are a lot of delays as a result of COVID. There are a lot of big projects, but it is an industry that's sort of going through its maturing phase. So there's been a lot of technical problems with a lot of these large wind farms. Now, Techmar has got some very interesting products, but, you know, it took some time for them effectively to build those relationships with really big prime contractors. I think they're starting to move to a much better position. But as you say, you know, there is a very long-term global secular trend in growth in wind farms, not just in the UK, but in North America and also in Asia. And it does have some very interesting technologies. I think recently that has gone through a recapitalization. There's some investors with, you know, who've had some very strong expertise in this area, but also the offshore area. And I know they've raised some money to potentially do some M&A. And I think roughly that is the right strategy for the business to build scale in what is a market with a lot of opportunity, but also a lot of very large customers who you have to keep honest.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, that's a sort of work in progress, but it has to seem to an inflection point. Another one which has been, well, the last one, which has sort of been through the ringer of late is Myriad Advertising, which does sort of like, it does product placement into videos, which go obviously, you know, things like TikTok and these sort of stuff. But post-production allows that technology. What's your sort of latest view here? Because, you know, I mean, the shares are almost like being written off.
Well, it's all about delivery, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's clear that, you know, there is a big market opportunity to place adverts, and it's very difficult for me to describe. It's best if you go and look on the Myriad site. There's some very interesting videos about how they sort of put these adverts into TV programs. But I think they've sort of shown that there is potential market demand. It's all about delivery, and a lot of that was making it scalable, so that you can do this for big customers. And they've gone through that process. They needed to raise a bit of money to basically fund them for the next 12 months. And I guess we're really at that point where are we going to see wide scale adoption? I think sometimes the market just sort of runs out of patience. I think they probably were delayed by 12, 18 months because of COVID. They were more focused on China. It's the right thing. They're focused primarily on the US. Mm. And if the US market does deliver, they'll then focus on Europe. And it's a big potential opportunity. But you know, as I said, it's quite a binary outcome. They've got probably the leading technology, but you know, you can never be quite sure.
Yeah.
And certainly they've got some very interesting customers, and they've got a lot of people in the industry all engaged with them. But at the end of the day, they've got to win the revenues. So I mean, I think they're positioned in the right place. But as you said, you know, it's almost an option. The shares are so lowly priced that if they can deliver, there's a huge amount of upside. But we will
wait and see. Work in progress. Okay, well,
very good management team, very driven, know the industry incredibly well. So I think if anyone can deliver it, they can.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, the fantastic insights there. Lovely selection of stocks we've gone through, some with excellent long-term visibility, others with really strong growth, lots of really excellent value there, and then a few sort of like a couple of exciting small caps right at the end that will be a bit higher risk, but certainly higher reward. So thanks for that, James. Now, if somebody wants to invest in sort of Columbia Threadneedle, I know there's obviously sort of compliance, but how best to do that? What should investors do? Go to the website or go to their IFA or what?
Yeah, well, we are obviously on all the major platforms.
Yeah.
Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell. Obviously, there are other platforms available. I can't still going to plug them. And my fund is the CT Smaller Companies Fund. We've abbreviated Columbia Threadneedle to the catchy CT.
Oh, okay.
But you can also actually go to the Columbia Threadneedle website if you want to invest in funds directly off the My Funds page. But yes, it's been renamed the catchy CT Fund.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again, and look forward in touching base in 6 months' time.
Thanks, Paul. Been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.